Jorge is traveling, so he asked me to chair this session, and we're also recording it. So the tape will be available later on. So this is, one of the first things for the International LQG Seminars. We're going to have panel discussion. And this was inspired by what happened 2 weeks ago in the last session. At the end of John Barrett's talk, there were a lot of questions, comments, and so on. So the session is divided into three parts. I'm going to give the first part, then Carlo, and then Laura. At the end of each of these three parts, we can have some short questions, and then we'll have longer time at the end of all three presentations. Okay, so let's begin with slide number one, and just the title slide, and it just says that we're going to have this discussion on topics from 2 weeks ago. Next slide, please. So the goal of this panel discussion is really these issues which have to do with semi-classical considerations. And the way it was formulated was, is it adequate to focus on states represented by just a few simplices with faces which have large areas, and therefore the dual graphs whose edges have large values of j's, or to really obtain semi-classical states, should we take, quote-unquote, a continuum limit so that we've got lots and lots of tiny simplices, so to say, and therefore we have dual graphs with lots of edges with low j values. Now, as formulated, this is quite vague. This is not sharp enough, really, to get a universal answer. And I'm going to make it a little bit sharper. And in Carlo's presentation, he will continue to sort of make it even further, even more sharp. So, basically, the issue is that the answer to such questions really are not universal, but they depend on the physical questions that one is interested in, particular observables, particular measurements, particular quantities that one wants to calculate. And also, when we discuss dynamics, there are two distinct issues, namely, to recover low-energy physics, the two possibilities are, A, what is the adequate description for boundary states? Which of these J's and what kind of coarse graining is required or is appropriate for the boundary states? And then the second question, namely, given certain boundary states, what is the adequate approximation for calculating transition amplitudes? Now, in this talk, I'm going to emphasize quantum geometry perspective, and this will be complemented by Carlo and especially Laura with the spin form perspective. So next transparency, please. So, one place where we consider kind of large objects are black hole horizons, or more precisely, isolated horizons. And in this case, the physical question we want to ask is, what are the microstates underlying a large, smooth, isolated horizon? This is what matters for the entropy calculation. Now, we all know that there is this very heuristic argument due to John Wheeler, which he called it from bit. It stood for entropy, and bit is a elementary piece of information, or a two-level system, a system which has exactly two states. And Wheeler's very rough idea was that we should take the horizon, the topological two surface, and we should divide it into elementary cells, each carrying an area about Planck length squared, and then to each cell we should assign a bit, that is to say, two states. Then the number of cells, of course, goes as the classical area A0 of the horizon divided by Planck length squared. This is the little m, and therefore the number of states, the script m, goes like 2 to the power little m. Entropy is given by the logarithm of big m, and therefore it is given by n log 2, so it is proportional to little n, which, as we saw in the slide before, goes like a naught upon lp squared, And therefore this very vague, rough argument says that the entropy should be proportional to the area of the horizon. Now this argument, it sort of sounds tantalizing, but it has many, many problems, and one has to make it precise in very different directions. But this was what was done in quantum geometry using spin networks in the Hamiltonian framework. And for example, we know that the quantum area are not Lp squared, but rather 4 pi gamma into square root of j into j plus 1, one is missing there, sorry, times Lp squared. The calculation has to know that the surface is actually an isolated horizon. There is a very delicate isolated horizon boundary condition. There are all kinds of issues about Chern-Simon theories and gauge invariance and mapping class groups and diffeomorphisms and so on. And we also had then to address the idea, the question, what is a quantum horizon? So this rough idea by itself doesn't really fly, but on the other hand, there is a very precise version of this idea that has come from quantum geometry. And now we can ask, in this idea, what is going on? If you take Wheeler's rough picture, then one would say that this is a two-level system, so only the spin networks with j equal to 1/2 should dominate, only they should contribute. Now, this does not turn out to be the case, but as Alex Perez emphasized 2 weeks ago, the dominant contribution does come from j equal to 1/2, although all other higher spins also contribute. And so, even when the semi-classical horizon is smooth and nearly flat, if it's a large black hole, the curvature is very, very low on the horizon, the microstates necessarily require lots and lots of small spins. So we can go to the next transparency.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Hi, Abhay. This is Jurek. So what is the reference to that new Perez's result?
No, there's no result. He's just pointed out last time when we were talking about what dominates. And he pointed out that people were saying that, well, in the semi-classical limit, maybe only large j's should matter. And Perez pointed out 2 weeks ago that no. This is just using the old ideas that, you know, all of us had developed, saying that, in fact, j equal to 1/2 gives a dominant contribution. Okay?
Okay, so you mean a contribution which cannot be neglected?
Right, but, yeah, okay. I have to say right away that all three of us are trying to pack too much information, so there are going to be many imprecisions, and all the three presentations, we want to get the gist of this, where the whole idea is to communicate, to start this dialogue, rather than give a final refined picture and final refined answers to the questions that were raised in the first transparency. Okay. So the black hole entropy calculation, however, refers to black holes in equilibrium. So as Laura commented last time, this is to do with not dynamics, but kind of statement having, there is dynamics, one is using Einstein's equation, but on the other hand, the dynamics is trivial. So now let us go to the second, next transparency, which has the second example. And this is really coherent states of photons. So, the coherent states of photons in ordinary Maxwell theory, these are dynamical semi-classical states. This really is a state which represents very well the quantum state of the Maxwell field in a laser beam, for example. Now, these coherent states are peaked at a given classical field, F min of k, and we are going to look at those profiles for which k is much less than omega Planck, so this is low energy physics. And as was shown in 2004, and I'm giving you this one reference just because I found here that students and postdocs don't know about this. This is sort of forgotten. In 2004, there were a whole bunch of papers by Varadarajan particularly, and then with Lewandowski, and then Ghosh and Fairhurst and Vailino. These papers looked at the standard Maxwell theory in the language of spin networks, or more precisely, flux networks, which are the U1 analogs of the spin networks. Spin networks have to do with representations of SU2. Maxwell theory has to do with U1. So we look at U1 analogs. And here, the basis vectors are written here. as script N, subscript alpha and I, of, and this is a function of connection. So this is a spin network function or a flux network function. I labels the graphs, the edges of the graph alpha, and NR are integers. So NR are analogs of the J labels in quantum geometry. The coherent state is peaked at A equal to 0 and E equal to 0 as an element of, so as an element of C star, it can be written out by the formula that is given below. So let me explain this formula. On the left hand side, we have the coherent state. On the right hand side, we have expanded it using a spin network basis. The left hand side coherent state is of course in Minkowski space. It knows about Minkowski geometry, positive negative frequency, etc. The spin net or the flux network basis doesn't know anything about that. And all this information is coded in the linear, the numerical coefficient, which is in this big square bracket, which sits in front of the particular flux network basis vector. So the linear combinations know about the metric, about the positive negative frequency decomposition, etc. And that linear coefficient is just exponential of h bar times summation over the edges times ni, the labels of the edges, times integral d3x times e naught minus summation over j, nj times fj times delta to the minus 1 half times fj, where fj is just a smear form factor for the ith edge. So this particular square bracket does know about the background metric because of the Laplacian power there, but the rest of the information is just E0, the classical field that we gave, and the spin network labels and J's. So here is the state here. And so now we can ask which of these spin networks actually dominate in this given classical state. Now for any given graph alpha, one can check very easily that the coherent state is actually peaked at the values of Ni, which are tailored to the given classical electric field E0, namely, the Ni should be such that if I take a large coarse-grained surface S, then the flux of E0, there should be E0 there, I'm sorry, E0 dot ds should be equal to the flux, the sum of the fluxons that the spin network state will give us. So summation over J and J. Next transparency, next slide, please. Maxwell theory continued. Now what we can do is, we can take this state psi and we can project it on any graph alpha naught. Because it's an element of sil star, we can just take the inner product with an element of sil, project it by the graph, project it on a given graph. What we obtain is, so to say, a shadow state that captures the coarse-grained properties of the original coherent state, where coarse graining is with respect to this label alpha naught here. Now, of course, now, if you want just electric fluxes across large surfaces S, then you can have a very coarse grained graph that suffices to obtain the right expectation values of the electric flux across a large surface. And all you have to make sure of is that the labels N's are such that summation over J is equal to the flux of the electric field. Since the surface is large, the flux of the electric field is large. If you have only a few edges which are intersecting, therefore these labels N's are large. So in this case, this particular shadow will be peaked on those labels and J's which are large. But it turns out that if you want to get more detailed information, we want to get recover the correct expectation values and fluxes for electric for the electric field across small surfaces S, then we need a finer graph. There should be lots of edges and lots of intersections with this S up here. Then the shadow is actually peaked at flux numbers 1. In other words, you need lots and lots of edges, each carrying a very small flux. So the answer to the question, which spins dominate in quantum gravity, is like saying which ends dominate here, and then the answer depends on which question we ask. So these qualitative remarks summarized, however, very detailed calculations. I've been quite sloppy, also some factors of two and so on. But the main conclusion is that appropriate coarse graining is dictated by physical considerations. To recover the leading order classical results, it often suffices to just use very coarse graft, and then one is led to use large ends. So this was Maxwell's theory, but dynamical considerations. Now let us go to general relativity or quantum gravity and dynamical considerations. And this is quantum cosmology. Now here, let us just consider a simple model, which is a Bianchi 1 model. In Bianchi 1 model, we have got three scale factors, because the universe expands in three different directions, in three different ways. So, for simplicity, let us suppose that the universe is just has a topology of three torus. The torus then has kind of three faces. And the area of each of these faces is what characterizes the physical state in loop quantum cosmology. So, the physical state is given by four numbers, P1, P2, P3. These are the areas of the three faces and evaluated at a value of the scalar field, phi equal to phi naught, and the scalar field is a relational time. So, at the time phi equal to phi naught, P1, P2, P3 are the three areas. Then, if I was really looking at it from the point of view of full loop quantum gravity, the state is going to be extremely complicated. It has much, much more information than just the three scale factors, and one needs a fine graph with lots of edges, with low J labels, of course also high labels, J labels may occur, but lots of J labels should be low, that is the important point. But if I coarse grain and I'm only interested in the three areas, then in fact, it suffices to have large labels PI, the PIs are really like J's, and therefore, in this case, if I coarse grain, then in fact, I only can look at large J's, that suffices. Now, dynamics is dictated by the Hamiltonian constraint, and we can construct semi-classical states, which actually follow the classical evolution in the low curvature regime. But this requires a very careful construction of the Hamiltonian constraint. And in that construction, we have to look at, in the definition of the Hamiltonian constraint, we have to look at plaquettes, which have minimum area, and these plaquettes do have very small, namely J equal to 1/2, spin labels. So in the construction of dynamics, the J equal to 1/2 has gone in, but in the construction of the final states, only large J's appear. Now, the remark in Brown, suppose full loop quantum gravity has a correct semi-classical limit. If we are interested just in the dynamics of the three scale factors, so supposing we are actually successful in discussing Bianchi type models in full quantum gravity, then we have all kinds of information, but we are only interested in the dynamics of the three scale factors. But coming from full quantum gravity, then we can coarse grain the inhomogeneities in the detailed state that we have, and the coarse grained loop quantum gravity state will then be well described just by these three numbers, P1, P2, P3, at a given instant of time, phi naught. So the P's are going to be large, so that is going to be like large AIs. And the hope, of course, is that these dynamics that we will thus get by coarse graining from loop quantum gravity will agree with the dynamics of loop quantum cosmology in the low curvature regimes. And this is going to be described using the LQC dynamics is described using large J's, whereas the detailed dynamics of LQG will have all kinds of J's, and in particular small J's. Now, one might say, well, this is a pie in the sky, but there is a very small indication that this may be right, and that is that if I start with a Bianchi 1 model, but if I integrate our isotropies in a precise manner, then we obtain exact LQC dynamics of the isotropic model. So, it is not completely stupid to hope that if I coarse grain inhomogeneities, I will get the mini superspaces from full quantum gravity. Last transparency. What about path integrals? Now, these path integrals also have been done in the LQC, but of course, we're going to hear much more about that from Laura and Carlo in the context of spin forms. There are two issues. as I said in the first transparency, namely specification of the boundary states and calculation of transition amplitudes. So first let us consider the boundary states. Supposing we have got a total volume V, supposing the manifold is not back, and suppose, let us look at the classical state that we are trying to approximate by our given boundary quantum state. And suppose that classical state has almost constant curvature, variations in the curvature are negligible on a length scale L. Then roughly we can divide this volume V into simplices, each simplex of the order of L cube, and roughly in each of these simplex the curvature is not varying very much at all. Then in a second step, we can construct a spin network which is adapted to this particular complex. Now this spin networks will involve large J's, because in this complex the area of the surfaces are large. By the very formulation of the problem, we are coarse-grained the boundary states. Now if you want the transition amplitude only between such boundary states, not between arbitrary ones, but only between such boundary states, then the arguments I presented in the Maxwell and Del QC loop quantum cosmology, they suggest that the leading order behavior will be given by considering spin forms with large J assignments. For such boundary states, then, there is no real tension between two things which apparently might look very different. Namely, the point number one, the true microstate can be very complicated, contains information which is much richer than that in the coarse-grained picture, and it will involve all kinds of small J's and so on. And two, the leading order transition amplitude is given by spin forms with only a few simplices labeled by large J. So to summarize then, what I am trying to argue here using examples from quantum cosmology, from Maxwell theory and black hole thermodynamics is that the answer to the question, do we need large J's or small J's and so on in any given calculation, really depends on the physical questions that we are trying to address. Okay, thank you, I'm done. There are short questions. Let us have this discussion now and then go on to Carlo. Any short questions? Okay, if not, Carlo, can you begin?
Yes, I'm here. Hello from Marseille to everybody. Is the sound okay? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes. Okay. So let me just say before beginning that there is everybody from Marseille here, plus Mike Reisenberger and John Barrett were visiting. So hello from them to everybody also now. All right, so the next transparency is my title, as I said, and the three orders, I'm the blue one, the last one. So let's go to transparency two, where I have listed some questions, which sort of have the questions that have inspired the idea of this exchange. Like Abai said, some more things I'm going to say here, repeat a bit what Abai said. First question, this was not mentioned by Abai, but it came out a lot in previous discussions. Do we have to think in terms of loops and spin networks, or do we have to think in terms of tetrahedra and four simplices? It seems these two physical pictures are opposite in the sort of canonical and covariant loop quantum gravity version. Question number two is that exactly what Abai was saying? Is flat space formed by many small tetrahedra with low spin or by few large tetrahedra with high spin? And related question number three, if in particular I'm interested in low energy physics, so can I compute it with a single four simplex or I have to go to some infinite triangulation limit or what in between? And question number four, how do we study the continuum limit if I have to do a continuum limit from the discreteness of Planck scale to the macroscopic? And question number five, which also came out, if a spin foam model is just like a new version of Regge calculus, of quantum Regge calculus, why isn't it that it shouldn't work like we're told quantum Regge calculus does not work? Now, the next transparency number 3 is like the previous one plus one line, and the line added is that I want to claim that all these questions are ill-posed, and in fact, more than ill-posed, they are misleading in some sense. The form they are posed is not correct. So what I'm going to do is to discuss a couple of them and say why I think this way of viewing things is wrong. It will very much go in the same spirit of what Abai was concluding. And then I will take a more sort of constructive attitude and say how I think one should correctly address these questions. And, of course, I will be very qualitative and very fast. I won't go in any detail, but just to sketch a possible point of view or way of going about all that. Let's go to number 4, transparency number 4, where I had, again, the first question, is quantum space made up of loops or tetrahedra? And I think that what's wrong with this question is that it disregards two things. First, it disregards quantum theory, and second, it disregards what we think we know about quantum gravity. And it disregards quantum theory because quantum theory is not about how things are, but how something responds to a measurement. I am not supposed to ask what is exactly the electron that goes to a double slit experiment. I can only answer what do I see if I make if I put a detector in one slit of the experiment or I don't. Similarly, the quantum gravity, what we have in the kinematical theory, is a set of operators with quantum numbers that tell us how the system, which is the gravitational field, responds to a measurement. So we have eigenvalues of certain geometrical operators, like area and volume, for instance, and it makes no sense to ask what is the geometry between one eigenvalue and the other. What is the what is happening between one line and another of a state, or what is the geometry inside a tetrahedron? Because that would mean asking something else, adding some other observable, and then having a different picture of what is going on. I think that these kind of questions, like what is the geometry inside of one of these tetrahedra, is like asking what is the shape of a photon, or what do I measure if I measure the energy in the space of occupied by half a photon. So these go beyond what quantum theory has given us. This does not mean, of course, that these pictures are by themselves wrong or misleading. They're useful, they're extremely useful, and they may give us relations between the quantities that we observe that we can study or not study, consider or not consider. What I want to insist is that they are not to be taken too seriously. It's wrong, I think, to take too realistically the idea of a space made by just lines or a space by a rigid flat tetrahedra. Now, similarly, in the same spirit, the next transparency, number 5, is flat space formed by few tetrahedra with high spin or many tetrahedra with low spin? Now, suppose I ask the same question as standard quantum field theory. How many particles are there in the Fock vacuum? Well, I want to claim that the answer is zero is correct, the answer is many is correct, the answer is infinite is also correct. It depends what does one mean. The standard Fock vacuum, say in a free quantum field theory, is the state with zero particles. So it's the eigenstate with zero eigenvalue of the number operator, so it's certainly there are zero particles. But it's also certainly true that if I make a measurement, if there are particles with a local detector, I see particles. And in fact, the smaller the detector, the more particles I see, and in some precise sense, there are particles, and in fact, in some precise sense, there are infinite particles. In fact, the Fock vacuum is full of particles. So the picture of the Fock vacuum being full of particles is not inconsistent with the picture of the Fock vacuum being the state without particles, because what we're talking about is not a realistic, classical, objective set of particles here, but a response of a state to different kinds of measurements. And similarly, how many particles are involved in a two-particle interaction? Well, two, of course, because there are two, but also three, because I'm exchanging, say, a photon in the little picture between two electrons, or more, because if I go a higher-order perturbation theory, there are more particles being involved, if I have more vertices, or infinite. If I sum up all the terms of perturbation theory, I have more and more particles. So there are infinite particles, but this doesn't interfere with the fact that if I want to compute the two particle scattering amplitude to some finite order into perturbation theory, that's what I do, and I have a finite number of particles. So it makes sense to say the two particles, or three, or a finite number, or infinite number, depending on what I mean. I think that the pictures that we draw about what happens in space-time, in quantum theory, are pictures that refers to the process and refer to the way we are computing the amplitude of this process. So they refer to the description of the calculation that we do to go from one to the other. And so they're different for different measurements and for different orders in perturbation theory. So this was sort of the negative part of my talk. Let me go to a positive attitude now. So what do I think next transparency number six is? What do I think is the good question that one has to pose? Well, the good questions are, first, what can we compute in quantum theory, in quantum gravity that makes sense, and how can we compute it? And why this question is important, because the next transparency number seven, I think that quantum gravity is really, in some sense, two different problems. One problem is how to find the right theory, which we expect to be a background independent theory. But then there's the second problem. And given a background independent theory, how do we extract physics from it? And especially, how do we extract systematically physics from it, not just in some particular cases, but sort of how do we systematically compute out of it in the way we know how to do in usual quantum field theory? And this is where all the difficulties are, the difficulties of quantum gravity, in a sense that this is what is beautiful about quantum gravity. This is why we all got fascinated by quantum gravity, because the standard answers of quantum field theory do not work. Why? Because in quantum field theory, one always first measures distances and time intervals. So these measurements are used to locate where one is in space-time and then measure the field. And here, distances and time intervals themselves are measurements of the gravitational field. So how do we proceed? Now, I think that something we need to compute if we want to claim that we have a theory is scattering amplitude. And I do believe that we're really problem number two, not problem number one. We have a lot about the theory. We have a lot of pieces of the theory, not the complete theory, but a lot of bunches of the theory, maybe sometimes in different versions, in different formalism. But now what is a key open problem is how to compute, and in particular how to compute scattering amplitudes if we want to compare this with quantum field theory, with string theory, with the rest of fundamental physics. So the question is, how can we compute scattering amplitudes in a background independent theory? And in particular, scattering amplitudes depend on the background, because they are excitations of small excitation over a flat space, so over a certain background space. So how do we tell a background independent theory that there is a background? And let's go to the next transparency eight. Now, I know one solution. I know only one solution to this set of questions that I've raised, which obviously doesn't mean that there aren't other solutions. I hope there are others, but these are the ones I know. And that I want to sketch in the next three slides. And the solution is based on three ingredients, which are conceptually distinct from one another and independent. One is the boundary formalism. Second is the vertex expansion. And the third is the large spin expansion. And I think in order to put some order in this, the pictures of large spins, how many, for simplicity, one has to keep these things separated. So let me just mention what these three things are. The next transparency number nine, I've just sketched what the boundary formalism is. And this is a way to answer the first question, what can we compute, which is meaningful. And the key point is, I think, that scattering amplitudes depend on the geometry, and they depend on the measured geometry around a scattering region. We have to tell the theory that there is a background, and the only way I know to tell the theory there is a background is to assign the state around the scattering region, and this state may be picked on a semi-classical geometry that induces via the classical equations a geometry inside, determines a geometry inside, and that's the way the theory knows about an inside background geometry without having to fix it. Now, this is not at all different than in standard quantum field theory. In the equation there in line number one is a standard definition of a two-point function, just an example. In line three, the same is rewritten as the expectation value of the evolution operator between a state at time t prime with one particle and a state at time t with one particle. And this can be rewritten as a scalar product in a larger Hilbert space, which is a tensor product of in and out Hilbert spaces, where on the right, one has a vacuum, which is the tensor product of the two vacuum, acted upon by the creation operators of the field, and on the left, one has the evolution operator. And in quantum gravity, this equation makes sense, because in the blue box, we have the same equation that makes sense in quantum gravity. One has one can construct a boundary state, and one has operators which act on boundary state. And we have the W, which is exactly what the spin-form model provides, if we use it sort of a leg of the theory together with the canonical theory. The W is an amplitude that assigns a complex number to every boundary state. Now, the point is that this quantity is four-dimensional diffeomorphic invariant. It's well-defined. So it's something we can compute, and it reduces to standard two-point function in flat space theory, so it's the quantity that may connect us to the standard perturbation, to the standard background-dependent theory. Now let's go to the next slide, number 10. This is the vertex expansion. So the previous point was about what to compute, now how to compute it. And what I want to stress is that there's no way in physics we can compute without a suitable approximation scheme. We can do some specific calculations, but there's always some approximation that comes in a field theory. And especially if we want systematically extract physics from the theory, we need an approximation scheme. Now, in quantum field theory, we always use truncations of finite number of degrees of freedom. I want to insist on that. For instance, in QED, if we are computing a certain scattering process to a certain order in perturbation theory, we are in fact truncating the theory to a finite number of particles, which is how many particles a certain number of vertex can create out of a certain number of incoming particles. So, in fact, all calculations of QED are all finite degrees of freedom calculations. Of course, as you go up with the order, you go up with the number of that's why you have a field theory, the number of degrees of freedom. But everything which is computed is always by the number of degrees of freedom. And the same is Lattice QCD. In Lattice QCD, what is computed concretely is by lattices, which are in fact very small, and which means, again, that we're computing in truncation of the theory with a finite number of degrees of freedom. And the number of cells is determined by the size of the phenomenon, big L, divided by sort of the minimum relevant wavelength, lambda. So we have to do something that's the same in quantum gravity. Is there a truncation to a finite number of degrees of freedom in gravity which makes sense? And of course there is. And it is to truncate generativity in a finite triangulation. And this is what the vertex expansion is. This is what this slide is about. And it's very much like lattice QCD. So the number of simplices is determined, obviously, by the size of the phenomenon divided by the minimal relevant wavelength. This is background independent in the same sense in which Regge calculus on a given triangulation is background independent, the sense Regge meant when he introduced Regge calculus. And it's not going to be good for anything, for everything, of course. You cannot do black hole entropy this way because you need the fluctuations of everything. This is a different kind of calculation. But it's going to be good in some instances. In which ones? All the ones where you can truncate generativity, typically cosmology. Cosmology, in a sense, is a full field of research based on truncating generativity on one degrees of freedom or three or six. If I'm computing two-point functions, and if I'm in coordinate space, not in momentum space, space in coordinate space, this means that I'm looking at certain distance, L, and I'm looking to wavelengths which are comparable. So I'm exactly in the context in which a truncation to a finite triangulation makes sense, and so on. Now, what I'm claiming is that it's easy to get an intuition of where this truncation is good. If I want, however, that's the last point of the transparency, to make a precise characterization of the regime of validity of this expansion, in the vertex expansion, this depends on the boundary state, the condition of the boundary state, but I think the way to find them is to calculate order by order and compare high orders with low order and find the precise characterization. This has to be done as posteriori, not a priori. Let me go on to the next slide, number 11. Now, the vertex expansion by itself has nothing to do with the large spin limit, which is a separate expansion. And the reason is that quantum gravity, the way we have it, is completely different than Regge calculus because there is a built-in scale, which is a Planck length. The length of the Regge links can be arbitrary small continuously. There is no specific Planck length. And that's not true for the areas in the spin for moments. So, therefore, it makes sense to say that I'm computing order, at each order of the vertex expansion, I computed something at a scale much larger than the Planck scale. So the vertex expansion by itself is not a large distance expansion, but there is a very large distance expansion, which is to take large spins, namely large areas. But large areas is large spins, which are the quantum numbers, so this means the high quantum numbers, which is the standard way of doing semi-classical limit, and so we expect that on a given truncation, if we go to a large area, large J, we expect to go down toward classical general relativity truncated on a fixed lattice, to go to Regge theory. So this is consistent with the way these large J expansions are studied in asymptotic expansions of the spin-form modes. So let me conclude. This is slide number 12. I'm just going to basically repeat the main points. I think that these pictures, loopy space, polymer space, triangulated space, are very good, very helpful for intuition, sort of give us what we want, but they have not to be taken too seriously, and they're not incompatible a priori between them. They maybe suggest different way of sharpening the definition of the theory, but it's not by themselves that we're talking about different theories. Second, in quantum gravity, flat space, and this is a key point, is not many small Planck scale things, and it's not a few big large spin four simplices. Flat space is a process between something incoming and something outgoing, so there's a transition amplitude associated to it, and we can represent the same flat space with different pictures according to the measurements we are considering, according to the calculation scheme we use to compute this amplitude, and within the calculation scheme, at different orders in an approximation scheme. Third, we must compute diffeomorphic invariant amplitudes, including when we deal with excitation over flat space. And the only way, I insist again, I'm not saying this is the only possibility, the only way I know for doing that is to code the background in the boundary space, and this is a boundary formalism. We need an approximation scheme. If we want to compute systematically out of quantum gravity, we need an approximation scheme. And in order to compute scattering amplitudes, the vertex expansion is one. The obvious criticism of the vertex expansion is that it reduces the theory to a finite number of degrees of freedom, but this is not a criticism because that's the way we compute in QED and QCD, where the technique seems to work pretty well. And five, the regime of validity of this expansion is clear. It's good when the size of the process is not much larger than the minimal relevant wavelength, that is called L here, was called lambda in previous transparency, I'm sorry. And this includes the large distance behavior of the scattering amplitudes in coordinate space. And six, again, distinct from a vertical expansion, is a large spin limit, which is a fixed ratio, L over little L over big L, namely a fixed order in a vertex expansion. This limit is independent from that and captures the processes which which happen at much larger scale than the Planck scale, and it has to go toward the classical theory. So this, of course, does not mean that flat space, once again, is made out of large four simplices. It means that we're describing measurements performed at scales larger than the Planck scale at a lower order in the vertical spectrum. And this is all. Thank you.
Are there any quick questions, comments? If not, let us go to...
Very clear. So.
Okay. No, I think there are questions, but there are probably... There are longer
questions.
There's
some questions here, but maybe we should...
Yeah. So let me move to the... Let me move to the first slide of my talk, which is number two. Okay. So as Abhay and Carol emphasized, I'm going to focus more on questions than answers and give some directions of investigation, I think, that are proposed by the recent results on spin-flow models. But what I want to emphasize first is that, to go back to the basic postulate of loop quantum gravity is in some sense is a radical postulate. It's the statement that SU2 spin network bases form a complete basis of the kinematical Hilbert space of pure gravity and a complete basis in which we can investigate the dynamics. I think it's an old statement, but it is still a very radical statement, and there's two reasons for why it's such a radical statement. The first reason, I think, is that spin network states are discrete objects in two respects. First, they are not labeled by continuous fields as we are used to. They are labeled by embedded graphs, which are objects not filling the space. That's one of the first radical feature about them. And the second feature is that the geometrical label they carry is discretized because it's quantized. They are labeled by half spins on the edge and spins on the vertex, intertwiner labels on the vertex. Now, despite this kind of double discreteness, this is the second radical statement, this basic postulate of loop quantum gravity is essentially that the knowledge of quantum gravity amplitudes for all possible discrete spin network states is equivalent to the definition of the full theory. And if you think about it, this is a radical shift from usual formulation of the theory. Now, the goal is then to be able to compute the continuum quantum gravity amplitude with boundary states given by the spin network states. And here I'm emphasizing that I'm talking about the full quantum gravity amplitude, even if I express them in terms of this discrete boundary state. So in the slide number three, I repeat this statement. I think it's an important statement because it seems to me that we have been shy about it in the sense that we have this spin network state, but we're trying to avoid them or, think of them, of course, graining, which we should and we could because there are other bases in which physics is described or classical physics is described. But in some sense, what our theory is telling us is that we should try to embrace them and then take them really seriously because they are not just some approximation. There are also some exact states of the theory, and maybe we should be able to develop a deep understanding about them. I'm emphasizing that having these basis of discrete state is not a discretization if we can achieve the computation for all elements of the spin network basis. So this is the same thing as, finding a discrete energy eigenstate basis for the harmonic oscillators. This is not the natural basis you would like to describe physics with, which would be the position basis, but it turns out that when you quantize, you get to the discrete basis. And then, we did lots of work, interpretation work, in trying to understand these discrete states. So the aim of spin-flow model is essentially to try to compute these amplitudes in these bases. To give a heuristic idea, in the usual formalism, we label states by continuous special metrics, and then one which to define the boundary state functional, which is written down here, which is written down as some path integral that, we wish to be able to define. And this is the key essential element of what Carlo was talking about earlier. Now, in the usual formalism, we label this boundary state functional by boundary metric. Now, in which I can think of as a particular basis of way of labeling boundary states, very very similar to the graviton basis. Now, in spin four model, one seems to define the same objects, but for boundary states labeled by spin networks. So if I go to the next slide, I repeat again that full quantum gravity corresponds to the knowledge of this boundary state functional, which is the guy we want to compute for all possible spin network states. Now, we can certainly restrict our study to the case where the graph supporting the boundary spin network states may be large, but it's finite. And the question is then, as Carlo was emphasizing, and Abai too, is to understand what approximation this really corresponds to, what type of observable one can compute in these sectors, so what really does that mean to make this restriction. In some sense, restricting to the sector where the boundary states are supporting on finite graphs amounts to probe gravity with some type of state that allows just small deviation from the flat boundary. And here I'm, vague because we need to understand that better. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the geometry, so we are using probes that are, restricted in some way, but it doesn't really mean that what we are probing, like the Bok geometry, is a flat geometry, in the same way that you can find, piecewise or some type of flat, a co-dimensional one surface in your curved background. So, to some extent, it's similar to probing the Bok geometry of usual gravity via insertions of boundary graviton, which is a different basis of boundary states. And one of the key, maybe open questions, is to understand what should be the overlap between these two bases. And Abai was showing, some element of answers to that question. So if I go to the next slide, slide number five, Now, suppose I take this restriction that I, study the theory with a fixed boundary graph. It's a valid question because this corresponds to some exact sector of the theory. Then it's a valid operation to try to consider the semi-classical limit of the amplitudes, in these sectors as a test and try to see whether we get the right semi-classical limit in order to test the proposal of the dynamics. So, as has been emphasized before, in this configuration, for fixed but maybe large graph, the semi-classical limit corresponds to considering large spin configuration. And then by duality, because spins is dual to curvature by the Planck-Schrelle formula, in some sense, large spins corresponds to probe the boundary states along, small curvature inside. So there are two questions I would like to highlight. The first one is, the first one is how large should be. I mean, in these studies, we usually, prove theorems for the limit j goes to infinity and so on. But is it a mathematical statement? So what does it mean to take, a large j? And the second question is, suppose I'm doing that, then how do I test the dynamics of the spin form? What should, in principle, the spin form amplitudes be asymptotic to in this semi-classical limit? So let me go to the next slide, slide five. So I don't want to emphasize too much, but how large should be, I just want to say when you do computation, it turns out that if you want to have an answer in many computations that you do, if you want to have an answer which is, accurate at below the person's level, then you will see that J, bigger than 30 is enough to get that result. And if you want to get, at the top, 0.1%, then J 100 is enough. Or of course, this is it depends on the type of computation. But what it means here, if you think this is Planck scale, so this is clearly large J here means, let's say, J 100 or J 50, which is still a very mesoscopic scale, which is way below any high-energy physics scale. So it is clearly an approximation to take this large J, but the building blocks that we're talking about are still, infinitesimally small compared to the scale of particle physics. So I think this is something to keep in mind, because it might be sometimes misleading to take, large J if you don't put the numbers there. Okay. The second thing what should it be asymptotic to? Well, if you have a quantum amplitude, then it's clear what it should be asymptotic to. It should be asymptotic to the Hamilton-Jacobi functional in the semi-classical list. That is the Hamilton-Jacobi functional that you compute with boundary data provided by your boundary states. So what we should, you know, look for is that this amplitude should be, you know, given by the exponential of the Hamilton-Jacobi functional of the gravity, the continuum one, evaluated on classical boundary configuration labeled by spin networks. And what I want to emphasize is that our claim is that this should be the Regé action, in fact, that arrives in the semi-classical limit. Let me go to the next slide. So here there's two types of questions that, you know, you can ask or objections that have been raised to me many, many, many times, which are the one I want to study now. So there are the basic two. The first one is that, okay, let's say I grant you that you can study gravity with this basis, because this is an exact basis, which has a finite spin network boundary state. Then, now we're talking about the spin form amplitude. This spin form amplitude should it not contain maybe an infinite number of vertices? So even if I have this finite boundary state, maybe, you know, inside I should have an infinite number of vertices. This is the question that was addressed by Carlo, you know, Carlo. And then the second question is, okay, I was talking about the Regé action. The Regé action kind of refer to some type of triangulation, and there is a priori no triangulation in this in the whole framework. We were just talking about spin network states and continuum and gravity states. So spin networks have nothing to do with triangulation. This is something that has always or very often been, you know, made to me. So why the Regé action? As I go to the next slide, let me try, you know. So for the first question, I think, you know, as Carlo was emphasizing, it might be that this is a key question, clearly. This is we need to be able to understand better what, you know, how does this finite boundary state percolate inside the bulk in some sense, and what does it mean to restrict to finite vertices. As Carlo was emphasizing, it, you know, understanding this question means maybe formulating it properly. In some sense, this is a very badly formulated question. But to some extent, in some formulation, it should be something that we address. What I want to say in the next slide is that the answer to this question is that, well, maybe not necessarily. That is, there is some evidence that the fact that you have a finite boundary state percolates inside the bulk, and this is something very specific to gravity, and this is something maybe very important, and this is maybe some, you know, directions that we should look more into. Now, corresponding to the second question here, I want to make a stronger statement. That is, yes, spin networks do have a precise relationship with triangulation, and I think we should, you know, also embrace that and try to understand better what does that mean or what it implies. But this is clearly, I mean, this is based on old results by Barbieri, but it's clearly that due to some recent results, we have a deeper understanding of this fact. So let me go to slide 8. So in slide 8, let me give an example. So I'm trying to address the question whether, you know, having just a continuum bulk theory, even if I have boundary states, means that this bulk theory inside should be, in some sense, infinitely refined. So suppose I look at one object, which is the Hamilton-Jacobi functional for, you know, real continuous classical gravity. And this Hamilton-Jacobi functional in general depends on the boundary metric in the usual formulation. Now, suppose that we evaluate this functional not on a general metric on the boundary, not a general three-dimensional boundary, but a certain type of piecewise linear metric. There's some restriction I need to put here that I cannot explain. Then, for a special subclass of three-dimensional piecewise linear metric, one can show that the continuous Hamilton-Jacobi action of 4D gravity is given when we evaluate on this type of metric by the Regé action of a simple, very simple four-dimensional complex. What it means is that the Regé action is not a discretization of gravity, but it is a continuum action evaluated on a certain class of boundary configuration, which are discrete. So In some ways, this is a fundamental difference, a fundamental change of point of view, that you can have continuum objects that, when evaluated on a restricted subclass of boundary states, do show or can be evaluated themselves by discrete techniques. It shows, it doesn't prove, but it shows that maybe, you know, there is a case to be made or to be investigated that maybe boundary discreteness might imply some type of bulk discreteness. So this is, you know, I don't want to claim that this is fully conclusive, because even at the classical level, I have to restrict to a particular subset of states. And you know, it's far from being proven. It might be wrong, but I think it's suggestive of one line of thought or direction of investigation that we should pursue. Next slide. If I go to the next slide, I want to make... I'm still okay on time, I guess. So.
Yes.
I want to say I want to come back to this point, which you know, which is a point of tension. I think it's an important point, because psychologically I can feel the field is splitting into kind of direction because of this point between the canonical and the spin form people who in spin form we kind of trade off freely sometimes, maybe too loosely, you know, between spin networks and triangulation. But the canonical people are completely blocked by, it seems to me, by this type of trade off. So I want here to make a case that there is evidence, and more than evidence, I mean, there is a relationship between spin networks and some type of discrete geometry. Okay. So, in general, it might be hard to have such a correspondence. So the first thing I need to make is that I can restrict the spin networks I'm studying, the spin network states, to be only four-valent. There are three reasons for that. First, this is the minimum valency I need in order to have a three-dimensional volume. If I go to less valency, I don't have any space. Now, a key point, a very important point, is that this is a superselected factorial theory. That is, there are many formulations of the Hamiltonian dynamics, but there's none of them that take a four-valent graph and map it to a five-valent graph. What does that mean? Is that it means that if you start from, or if you prepare states which are in this sector, then you will always stay in this sector no matter what the dynamic is. So you can safely first study the dynamic of the theory in this sector. And then, you know, as these recent studies have shown, this is a sector that contains enough semi-classical states to be able to reconstruct discrete geometries. So there's enough of them. Now, if we look more at the structure of the input space of the theory, based on the given graph, the space of L2 function on the given graph of spin network states, then it decomposes the sum of all possible spins labeling the edge, and then there's a tensor product for each vertex. And for each vertex, we need to insert an eta Twiner space, which is the space of invariant vectors, labeled by the spins that arise here. Okay. So if I go to the next slide, so this is the main point. In some sense, the space L2 factorizes as a product of spaces associated with each vertex. And then we can look at what...
Can I make a comment?
Yes.
This is Jurek again. So there was a statement on the previous slide that there is no Hamiltonian which increases the valency of vertices.
No Timian Hamiltonian, at least. So do you know one?
Yes, of course. I mean, there is this ambiguity in how we turn F mu nu into a loop.
Yeah, but okay.
So
we can
attach a loop which increases. Actually, in our...
No, if you attach a loop, you're not going to increase. You're just going to change.
In our review, which I wrote with Rabai, we proposed a regularization which exactly increases this valency per 2. So it would turn 4-valent vertex into 6-valent vertex.
Okay. So there is some. So let me restrict to the study where... Let me restrict to the study of Timan Hamiltonian. And maybe we can discuss that. And in spin-form models, this is a key thing, that the dynamics is really not changing the valency, or not increasing the valency. Okay. So I didn't know that result. I should look into it. So I'm back to slide 11. So now the basic, you know, main result, which is no result, is that the space of intertwiner for four-valent intertwiners is really the space of fuzzy tetrahedra. That is, you know, you can really think about this
at least at the classical level, it's clear that the phase space associated with this Hilbert space is really the phase space of geometrical tetrahedra. Now, there are two types of new results, and I don't have any time to even give them a good description here, but is that now we do understand better first the space of intertwiner at one vertex. So we can label at the quantum level, even at the quantum level, the coherent space by real geometrical tetrahedra. And then we can even show further, this is maybe something that Simone might talk about later, that the space of L2 gigamma, the space of Spinetta space, or even the phase space, is really isomorphic to an Hilbert space that can be associated to a translation and discrete geometry. So we can have an isomorphism there also for the full Hilbert space with discrete geometry. So this is a kind of new interpretation, or a sharper, it's not completely new, it's a sharper interpretation of spin network states as being related in a precise manner to geometry of triangulation. So let me conclude now, 12. So on these slides, the main point I wanted to emphasize is that we can restrict to the study of quantum gravity with boundary states feeding on large but finite graphs. And maybe we should embrace that more fully. We have to learn what type of physical question this framework allows to address, what type of approximation it corresponds to, and this is what, you know, Carlo was emphasizing. Now, boundary states are related in a fundamental way to discrete geometry, at least in the four-valence superselected sector. The semi-classical limit of quantum gravity amplitude in this sector is expected to be related to the gravity Hamilton-Jacobi functional, which is the Regge action. And then, there might be certain physical questions that cannot be captured in this approach. So I thought a lot about trying to get the ADS CFT partition function, and it seems to me that if I want to get that, I need to have both infinite graphs and infinite spins. So clearly, you know, and it might be the same thing that the S matrix functional or computing the overlap with the graviton state, which is another basis, you know, needs to go to this infinite graph. Thank you.
Okay, so time for questions, discussions. Let's take questions first and then have a general comments and discussion.
There's a question from Michael. A comment from Michael Eisenberg is here.
Okay, are there any questions first? Okay, so I have one question and then we'll go to the comments. And this is a kind of a key question to both Carlo and Laura. So maybe I can go. We can just go back to the conclusion slide of Carlo's. I think it was Carlo's slide number 12. And the point I'm going to ask about also came up in Laura's talk. And I think Carlo is emphasizing rightly that in physics, we want to calculate something, we usually formulate the question and then choose an approximation method. And going to a finite number of vertices is no different from, you know, truncating the perturbation theory in QED to some order and so on. But I think there is a key difference, namely that we believe that quantum gravity is finite. I mean, exact quantum gravity is finite, not some approximation of it, etc. So if I wanted to go beyond statements about calculating something to a control approximation, but want to know, is the theory actually finite? Then I would not know what vertex, order in the vertex expansion, I'm supposed to stop. Just like in QED, I don't know. Now, therefore, the question about, you know, existence of the theory, does it not require this going to infinite refinement? And this is a question also came up at the end of Laurent's talks about it, when he's talking about S matrices and some other questions. So maybe Carlo, if you have any comments, and then maybe Laurent, if you have any comments.
Yes, I, 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 my, I have an answer. The answer is that I think that you're right. So it's two different issues. One is to compute a transition amplitude to some approximation, and a different issue is do we believe that the theory is a finite theory that gives us this amplitude as a finite number? And and I agree that because this is quantum gravity, the second question is, in a sense, is much more important than the same question in QED or QCD. Yes, I agree that to address this question, one has to study the continuum limit, so to say, and to study the infinite triangulation. So I would agree entirely. Now, what I could add is that here in France, for instance, Karim Nowy and Matteo Smerlach are studying this question in 3D, just to learn how to do the results from... Simone, do you have results on that? The pieces of results on that with Razvan. So it's not that this question is being neglected, as far as I know. This question is very much present. And the way Vincent Rivasseau is getting into this game and addressing this this game is exactly around this question, and this has to do, of course, with if I do the vertex expansion like a perturbation expansion, like summing the series all the way to the end of the so this question is essential. I would keep them separated from the relatively much easier set of questions, which a physical problem of computing to some order in perturbation theory when the other orders are physically smaller in the set, like in QED, one go to... I mean, all the physics at CERN is basically done to first order, to zero order, first order in perturbation theory. So yes, I agree with what you said.
Okay. Laura, do you have anything to add?
Yes, sometimes I, you know, this is the point I was trying to make in, let's say, about the Hamilton-Jacobi function for gravity. So I would have a stronger point of view, in some sense. But, the point I was trying to make there is that the fact that we're looking at amplitudes with discrete boundary states means that, so I agree with you that we should, this is a central question, we should focus on trying to continuum gravity amplitude. Okay. But what I was trying to say is that continuum gravity amplitudes based on boundary states which are discrete does not necessarily mean that you have to take infinite vertex inside. And I was giving one example of that, and it might not, which is that, you know, in classical theory, these things happen, especially for gravity, not for usual field theory. So, it seems to me that this is maybe one of the hopes of spin network models, that I need to be able to have a vertex amplitude that is infinitely refined in the sense that the 1 to 5 move is satisfied, which is essentially what the Rege action does satisfy. But then once I'm there, if I take a finite boundary state, then it well may be that in order to compute this amplitude, I don't need to... I mean, in order to compute this exact amplitude with finite resources on the boundary, it will maybe that I don't need to have an infinite number of vertex inside. I can get the exact answer by some finite resources inside. So it seems to me that this is one of the, you know, for me, this is a kind of cornerstone of spin for my hypothesis. This is where these things, this framework will be very successful if we can demonstrate that such a thing is true. Or, you know, I would be very happy to see that such a thing cannot be true for gravity. But I think, I guess my point is clear. I think, you know, this naive idea that you should need to refine infinitely is not correct generically. You have to take into account the fact that the boundary state is of a very, very special type, and that might change everything.
Right. So that is exactly the key question. However, even if it does turn out, I mean, I think it's not clear to me that it will turn out, because as you yourself had on your transparency 9 emphasized that it is not conclusive, and because even in the classical formula, it's really for special class. But even if this does did turn out, then the statement is that, I mean, it's very interesting and very profound, but still the statement is that for a given boundary state, you would only need finite number of vertices inside. But if you looked at, you know, all boundary states, because I can put there any boundary state I want, since the number of vertices and the j's and the boundary states are not restricted by themselves, if I want to know something like, you know, the full theory, I mean, as you were saying, trying to compute graviton amplitude, which may well involve the boundary state may well involve an infinite linear combination of all spin network states. So therefore, to calculate some physical questions, to get an exact answer to a physical question, one may still need, even if your conjecture is true, one may still need to consider infinite vertices in the bulk.
I agree. But I think there are two points of it. The first point is that when can we claim that we have a definition for a full theory of quantum gravity? So suppose that what I say is true, which, as you say, you know, there might be, you know, it's not conclusive at all, and it's a big leap of faith or something. But suppose this is true, that if you give me finite boundary states, then I have a way to prescribe the continuum amplitude. Then the claim I made is because of the loop quantum gravity hypothesis that the boundary state spin networks are a complete basis. Then this is you can claim then that you have a definition of the gravity amplitude, in the same way that if you know the transition amplitude in the energy basis, for instance, for your system, then you have a definition of the full continuum theory. Now, this is a major statement. So then what you're asking furthermore is that you might say, well, I'm not interested in that basis. I mean, and this basis is an exact basis. So we usually... I mean, we know that this basis is an exact continuum basis, but we keep treating it as if it was some approximation. So that's the first point. I mean, if such a thing is true, this means that we have a definition of a theory of quantum gravity. So that's a very, very strong statement and might well be completely wrong. The second thing is that if I have a definition of a theory of quantum gravity, then I can decide to study it, you know, in a basis or in another basis. And it might well be that for some questions... that are questions usually asked, I need to be able to, you know, make, I mean, consider boundary states which are infinite refinements or, you know, infinite linear combinations of these bases in the same way that if I have the spectra, you know, the answers in the energy basis and I want to go to the position basis, then I need to make a transcribable Fourier transformation and an infinite combination. But this is an operation at the level of the boundary state. So it's an operation at the level of what type of operations we perform on the boundary. It has nothing to do with the definition of the theory.
I completely agree.
So I think, you know, that's why for me the simple strategy is splitting these two questions. They are different questions. One is to be able to define the theory in these bases, and then then from there there will be two things. First, maybe we should take for serious these bases instead of trying, like we do take for serious the energy bases, and we don't always go back to the position bases. That's one strategy, and we haven't tried that enough. And the second one is, of course, to be able to go to this other, you know, compute these other overlaps and there I would agree with you that if you want to get the S matrix elements, then I would expect that I need an infinite number of, you know. But this is a different, it's more like, you know, making an operation on the boundary, which is something you can control. Yeah.
Okay, I just want to make one remark on what you said just now, and then we'll open up for discussion for general comments. Namely, that you said several times that we don't take this spin network basis seriously. I think that maybe there's a generational problem, because I think certainly Carlo and Jurek and Lee and I took it extremely seriously, and in fact all the popular talks and semi-popular talks were emphasizing that this is exactly like the energy basis and of the harmonic oscillator, etc. And in fact, when Carlo and Mike Reisenberg first came up with our general ideas about how to do path integrals, I was a little bit skeptical about whether this is going to work, precisely because of what happens if you use discrete basis for the harmonic anharmonic oscillator and for the rotor, coupled rotors. And I did the path integral using the discrete basis. and convince myself that in fact you do get exactly the right answers, and that is why, you know, I was, my unease went away. And the second point, again, because you sort of brought up these four valent vertices, graphs, etc. seriously, I mean, Urek is completely right. There are Hamiltonian prescriptions which don't respect this. But again, the idea that maybe we should just look at four valent graphs and then look at the dual tetrahedra is something that has been around for a long time. It is something, for example, that Luca Bombelli and I were talking about using this Voronoi graphs and, you know, sprinkling, random sprinkling of points, etc. That actually naturally gives you four valent graphs. So these ideas have been around in the literature. It's just that the new generation seems to have perhaps have forgotten. Okay. So Mike, your comment and any other comments?
Yeah. Okay. I certainly agree with most of what all of you said, and particularly with what Carlos said. But I wanted to emphasize that when you have different pictures, let's say you do a calculation with large spins, restricting to large spins, and other calculations calculate other phenomena like black hole entropy with allowing small spins, then the model that you use in the two calculations should be connected by a renormalization group flow. It seems likely. So the models, the spin flow models, which where everybody is trying to or very happy to show that they reproduce more or less classical gravity in large spins, these should be interpreted as the end point of a renormalization group flow of some other model with small spins, presumably. This seems like a reasonable picture. And this is a very hard problem. I think this is probably the main hard unsolved problem in spin foam approach, how to renormalize. And I think it's absolutely fundamental because, there's the old in perturbation theory, you always hear that quantum gravity can't be done because it's not renormalizable and you need an infinite number of counterterms. Now, when you work with spin foams, there aren't the ultraviolet divergences. They seem to be absent. So part of the problem is cured, but there's no reason to believe that the other part of the problem, that you can add an infinite number of changes to the model at a microscopic scale, that is cured. So if we guide ourselves only by requiring a certain classical limit for large scale features, then that still leaves an infinite freedom, or seems to leave an infinite freedom for the microscopic theory. And after all, what we want is the microscopic theory. I mean, it's very nice to recover classical gravity for large simplices or a classical limit of the theory. But we already have classical gravity, and what we want, really, ultimately, are the corrections. Now, which model should we believe? We don't seem to have universality to allow us to construct the microscopic model just using the classical theory. So we have apparently an infinite collection of possible microscopic models. How do we choose? Well, we don't. As I said, it seems to don't have universality, so you can't proceed as field theorists usually do, but you can proceed as scientists usually do, and take microscopic models and take the ones that seem somehow to be simpler or more convincing than others, and try them one after another, comparing them with experiments. But again, to be able to select these microscopic models, we would have to be able to find which microscopic models which lead after renormalization to models which match general relativity in the classical regime. So I think this is a big, very important problem, the renormalization of basically integrating out small simplices to make big simplices.
I mean, I think you made 2 points, and I completely agree with you, that the first point was that, well, we don't have a unique microscopic model because there is no universality. The viewpoint that Carlo and I and many other people have said many times is that, well, let us get one consistent thing that works and then worry about uniqueness. But nonetheless, I think this is something that is going to hound us, right? I mean, and this is exactly what particle physicists or string theories or something come back and tell us, that normally when in ordinary field theories, there is this discretization freedom, and then, but that doesn't matter because in the continuum limit, that, you know, the differences are all irrelevant. Now, in our case, we're not, as Laura and Carlo and I, all of us said, that fundamentally there is a discreteness. It's not that we're taking a continuum theory and discretizing it. There really is discreteness with the spin network basis or spin forms, etc. But still, there is a lot of freedom in defining the Hamiltonian constraint or the spin form amplitude, etc. And unless we have a principle which actually narrows down this freedom, it's not clear to me that we're, I mean, that we're not going to be left with, you know, for all practical purposes, 10 to the 500 different microscopic quantum field theories. And even if one were to actually construct the renormalization group flow, which I agree is a very important point, it may be that 10 to the 200 of them go to the macro, correct macroscopic limit. So I think that there's a fundamental problem. I mean, I think that we are just not mature enough to look at so far, but I think it is lurking in the dark. I would be very happy if somebody completely disagrees with me.
I'm sorry, but I don't completely disagree with you. I also would like a couple of comments to what Michael said. As you said, it's really 2 points. One is about universality and one about normalization. And they're connected, but they're two different points. And about the universality, which was second comments, I agree with what you said, but I would put it very stronger. I don't see all these hundreds of spinform models. In fact, I see none. And I even get a bit nervous when people can say, oh, yes, I can do all sorts of things. If you can do all sorts of things, why don't you do it and give me all these alternative models which give all this richness? Then I would be very happy. I mean, if we will have zillions of quantum theory of gravities which are consistent, which are background independent, which are lowest invariant in the limit, which go to general relativity, which you can compute, which is, where are they? I mean, there are many QCD on the lattice that all work. And they are shown to be equivalent where, in the sense that we need. But there aren't all these spin-form vertices. In fact, we had one from John Barrett that we were very happy, and we sort of thought that it worked, but then it didn't really work, and then it was corrected a little bit, and now it seems to work, and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. We have reasons to believe it works, but we have also fears it wouldn't work. And I don't see such an easy way of finding other ones, which means that maybe there are intrinsic difficulties, so maybe there is some uniqueness, or maybe not. But why worry before finding it? It's like, plus, uniqueness, I think it's a very overemphasized thing in modern physics. Extremely over it. There's no sense in which general relativity is unique. There's no sense in which Young-Mills theory is unique. There's no sense in which QED is unique. There's no sense in which physics is unique. You just find a theory that fits with reality. And then if it is wrong, you go and look for another one. This is the way for science has always worked. The universality of the quantum theory, I'm not sure it has to be taken as our main worry. Our main worry, it seems to me, is to find a consistent theory which has general relativity as a classical limit and is consistent with quantum theory and possibly fits with experiments. Then we'll worry about it. We've been saying it many times, and I know that people are not going to convince. Let me go to the other point, which is the renormalization group flow. I just want to add one thing which I believe is new. I mean, at least we haven't said many times, the other one, which is this. We certainly have to study how these things are normalized. This might have nothing to do with going to an infinite fine, to refining the triangulation. If we have a triangulation where there's a bubble, there is a possible the normalization, because we can replace the bubble with a single vertex. Let me phrase it in a different way. In QED, renormalization, all the renormalization game can be played in a sector of QED, which is a finite number of particles, right? You just have an electron that's split up in a photon that split up into electrons which are combined, and this is a finite number of particles, and you have an infinity, you renormalize the propagator, you renormalize the vertex, and you have for instance, you have a coupling constant with flow with a distance, and so you have the full renormalization group acting. So the same can happen here. And I think this has to be studied. In my opinion, is the main thing we have to study now. So we have to see if there is a, what is the effect of what there are loops in quantum theory, which would be bubbles here in a spin form, on the amplitudes. And so that, for me, is one of the main chapters to study right now. What I want to emphasize is that this can be studied on a triangulation with five tetrahedra, no more. All the problem is already there and to be addressed.
Thank you, Carlo. Other questions, comments? We'll keep going. We might be cut because our official time on the bridge is over, but we can still keep going because there may not be anybody after us.
Hi, I've got a comment about your too many quantum gravity scenario, which I think I share with Carlo. The point of view, this would be a nice luxury to be in. But I'm fairly optimistic that, you know, if and when we do get there, we'll start to discover the mathematical principles on which these models are made. And then we'll find that some have much better mathematical properties than others. And perhaps there'll be a whole load which we can just throw away because they're too sort of weak in a sense. So I think, once we start getting there and finding the right theories, then there's sort of a mathematical exploration to be done, which is, what are the really key properties of these models? And what properties, imply strong properties about the low energy limits and so on? And what can we prove about the quantum theory and so on? I think, we'll start to discover completely new properties of the theory which we didn't know about before, and we'll organize this chaos. That's my sort of optimistic point of view on it.
Right. Now, I think that's my point of working point of view also. So I just want to add a couple of things. Why do I raise this then? Basically I've been agreeing with Carlo, and I've had the same point for many years. The reason I'm raising this is twofold. One is that already, loop quantum cosmology already, one finds that, you write down a Hamiltonian constraint which looks completely nice and completely natural, and then look at it, and was around for a few years in the literature, and people didn't look at it. But then when people looked at it in great detail, then it turned out that it had completely horrible properties in the infrared. In other words, it cured singularities, but it did not agree with general relativity in the tame situations. And then, of course, we threw it out, and we got this. But this was delicate. And unless we actually had worked out the consequences, about what happens in the infrared limit in detail, we would not have known that. We might still be working with this Minor scheme, which had been around for quite a while. Now, if this is happening in quantum gravity, loop quantum cosmology, which is finite number of degrees of freedom, my worry is that this might also, the issue in full quantum gravity might be much worse. So that is my point number one. Namely, that yes, our first priority is to find one of these things. But secondly, to know which is good and which is not good, may involve very detailed work, and it would be much nicer if we really had a better insight. Carlo said that nothing is unique. That's true. But nonetheless, there are principles. Among all possible quantum field theories, we have got gauge principle. That restricts it. It doesn't uniquely determine the theory, but it restricts enormously. We have got equivalence principle. So we don't have two metric theories. It doesn't determine relativity uniquely, but it restricts it. And it seems to me that it's going to be very useful to find. We're not looking at it. Nobody's looking at it. And I think to have that at the back of one's mind, to think of looking for these principles, is really important, I think. Even at the time when we don't have a single theory. And my second point is just that, I mean, at least Thomas Thiemann, as the way I understand it, listening to his talks and so on, does think that in the Hamiltonian gravity, there are solutions. There are many solutions. And then, I mean, people like me or Jurek would say, that, well, yes, but there are all these ambiguities. And the problem there, again, is that, I mean, I expect that most of them would not have a good semi-classical limit, etc. But how do you go about checking it? I mean, checking each description one at a time is extremely slow, extremely laborious. Nobody has done anything about this. And this is when people, you know, field theory people come and talk about this. It's often dictated by Thomas's mathematical frameworks, which seem to indicate that there are many ways of taming the Hamiltonian constraint and writing down quantum gravity theory. So it's not, I mean, in spin form you don't have one, but in loop quantum gravity, I mean, Thomas has written down many. So the fact that we have many candidates, and in loop quantum cosmology also, we have these candidates which had to be ruled out by very detailed considerations bothers me. That's the reason that I bring this up. Other comments, questions, remarks?
I'm happy to comment, but I'm happy to let people that haven't spoke.
Okay, so anybody who has not spoken, please, and wants to make any, ask question, raise comments first, and then, if not, then Laura.
Okay. I want to agree with many of you and disagree with some of you. So it's a combination. This question of uniqueness, I think, is a very, it's a very strong requirement that we should tend to, and that we will validate what we do. I mean, if we don't succeed, it might be, I don't know, I would take it seriously if we don't succeed to be able to restrict the theories we're looking at. Essentially, by having theories that do satisfy the diffeomorphism constraints, so that in some sense do behave properly under diffeomorphism. This is how you can rule, I guess, most, you know, many of the proposals at the Hamiltonian level or at the quantum level, is that if you don't have the proper algebra of symmetry which is there, then you have anomalies, and that might not be very, the dynamics you're describing is just very approximate. Now, it is true, as Carlos was saying, that it took us, what, maybe 10 years to get even one example of a spin form model that has SU2 boundary states and the proper semi-classical. So that's a non-trivial feat, and it turned out to be very, very complicated. I would also agree with him that by looking at the bubble is the key. That is, suppose you go back to the classical level. You make a comment about that we don't, I was slightly willing to take that too seriously. I would still say that we haven't completely understood the classical meaning of the states we're talking about, and that's why there's so many state of confusion. But if I go to this, let's say, Regge action, As Michael was saying, you know, I can add many different terms from the Regge action. I can take the sine of the angle or the tangent of the angle or some higher order corrections or higher order curvature corrections. So I believe there's an infinite number of discretization of gravity that I can write. But the Regge action is unique in a very simple way, is that this is the only action that is invariant under the 1 to 5 moon. So it is the only action for which which is sitting exactly at the fixed points of the renormalization group. And in some sense, in that sense, it is not a discretization of gravity. It is uniquely distinguished. So there is some, that's the hope I was raising again and again. I think there is some hope that this phenomenon that we observe at the classical level, and I think we don't even understand properly, we should look for it at the quantum level, and it might be here. There's a way maybe to reduce this ambiguity as we do in the classical theory, as we can do in the classical theory.
Thank you, Laura. Any other questions, comments? this is the last International Loop Quantum Gravity Seminar for this academic year. We start again in the next academic year. And Jorge is not with us today, I think, but let's thank him for organizing all this throughout the year. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you, bye-bye.